Hello, I'm Mischievous Mark Giannacchio, and I own every issue of Amazing Spider-Man, Amazing Fantasy 15, and all of the Amazing Spider-Man annuals, which I say do not count.
And I'm Dapper Dan Gavazdin, and I own every issue of Amazing Spider-Man, including those Amazing Spider-Man annuals, which I still think count towards my collection. But for me, Amazing Fantasy 15 remains a fantasy. Welcome to The Amazing Spider Talk, the show where two fans and collectors uncover the strange, fun, and fascinating history of the Spider-Man comic universe. Thanks for joining us for a new review episode of The Amazing Spider Talk.
If you want to swing along with us on our journey through Spidey's past, present, and future, subscribe to Amazing Spider Talk on your favorite podcast app, and of course, leave us a review to help spread the word about our show.
Yeah, that's both on iTunes and on Spotify because they've just enabled reviews there too. So if you're listening to this on Spotify, give us a nice review. But this podcast exists because of the support of our Patreon members. If you want to receive early episodes, exclusive artwork, and keep our podcast going, go to AmazingSpiderTalk.com and consider joining our Patreon. Today on the show, Mark and I are going to be discussing Amazing Spider-Man, Volume 6, Number 42. Is it the reintroduction of Mary Jane? No. This issue, this issue was written by Zeb Wells. The cover and interior artwork is by John Romita Jr., inks by Scott Hanna, colors by Marcio Menez, and of course, letters by VC's Joe Caramagna. This issue was first released on January 17th, 2024. Mark, why don't you give us a recap of this issue?
Thanks, Dan. We open on a bloody tombstone and Kingpin staring each other down with Spider-Man reacting to Kingpin saying the gang war is over. Fisk says that the war has come to a conclusion that is acceptable to him, and that makes Tombstone start raging that Kingpin would brag about killing his daughter while smirking, until She-Hulk rightly points out that all of the subterfuge and vagaries and Kingpin's wording here, you know, all that doublespeak, she's like, he's got nothing, and he doesn't have nothing. So we flash over to Beetle and Rose, and indeed, Kingpin's goons have neutralized Digger and are now carrying the Rose out, kicking and screaming. Janice calls Lonnie and confirms she's all good, and Kingpin announces that he's sitting this gang war out, causing Spider-Man to speak for all of us when he says, so what was the point of the last issue and half of this story? You see, it turns out that Fisk just wanted to mix it up, so he wishes Lonnie well and warns him that this is all a power grab by Madam Mask and to watch his back. We're back over to the Syndicate, who are licking their wounds. Janice recognized that Madam Mask is making her move to take everything and will eventually turn her attention to them. That brings Digger back to life, upgraded to alive, looking for Rose, so the Syndicate breaks it to him that he bailed, but they're willing to bring him in onto the team if he's interested. All right. So now, we're downtown, and Madam Mask is getting the recap of things from Shotgun. She blows something into her face. Maybe it's another face mask. Maybe it's some lovely perfume. It's hard to see, Dan. And as Shotgun is talking, he starts to ramble about being sent to kill her, which causes Mask to do some incantations and to rub a glowing sigil on his arm. And my God, they're doing secret scrolls in gang war, Dan. What is this? Anyway, Mask delivers a nice mafia movie line that she only leaves enemies breathing that serve her purpose. All right, you say that, Madam Mask. Well, anyway, we flash over to Luke Cage on the Upper East Side, where he's taking care of business that you can read all about in his miniseries. Spidey asks if Cage can join his crew, and Cage is like, I got my hands full, so see you later, Spidey. Bye! And it's back over to Harlem and Janice and the Syndicate, as well as a subtle plug to read Spider-Woman. Janice happens upon Mask, who's admiring her maps. The two have some stilted dialogue before Mask starts to give her supervillain origin story in an attempt to get Spider-Man fans to actually care about the fact that she's the main antagonist of this story. Apparently 3 months ago, Nefaria ordered Mask execution. She was tipped off, which is why she's going full speed on taking over all of New York. Janice tries to one-up the patriarchal problems by talking about how vacant Tombstone was in her life. It made her feel like she wasn't good enough for him, so that's why she's now planning to win the war. Mask tells her to meet her at the playground at 12 noon tomorrow and bring snacks. And Janice says, of course I'll bring snacks. You better bring snacks too, or something like that. That's how it read to me, Dad. I don't know. We get one more check-in with Tombstone, Spidey, and She-Hulk, and Tombstone is being pensive about what's about to happen. Spidey says he'll make sure they are the winning team, and then he remembers that Randy got shocked because this comic seems to have forgotten that important inciting incident of the story before jumping away with She-Hulk. That brings us to Central Park in the middle of the day, and of course there's nobody there but the Syndicate and Mask and her AIM army. Janice has apparently recruited an army of her own, which I have to imagine consists of all of the homeless people living in the New York City subway system that Fox News keeps scaring my father about. And that brings us to the final scene, where the two armies start running towards each other on the Great Lawn, like it's the theme song of X-Men the Animated Series. And Janice shouts out, "They can take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom!" Or something like that.
Perfect, Mark. You have a stunning impression of Janice and Lonnie and all these characters. So getting started here, you know, I think last episode we talked about the kind of dubious nature of who these troops were that were showing up at the end of the issue. And it turned out it was exactly as shown, Kingpin's like advanced guard, so to speak. They're the super troopers or whatever you want to call them. And so I think we can put a pin in that speculation of any type that existed. So if you listen to that episode, sorry that we wasted 5 minutes of your life talking about that. But, you know, I still think time well spent. Speaking of like misdirection, this is one of those classic covers where whatever's happening on the cover is definitely not reflected in the pages of this comic, which then makes you think, is that coming down the pike? We will find out, I guess. As to what's really at the core and maybe should have been on the cover of this issue is I think this issue is really all about setting up Madam Mask against Janice Lincoln. This like war of the daughters, you know, that is going to play out here. It's both of them take their daddy issues to the battlefield of Central Park. I guess it must be winter there because nobody's out there sunning themselves. Mark, my question for you is, you know, we finally have seems to have reached the like both of the kind of spearheads kind of being pointed at each other. They've both subsumed so much of the city. This is the big clash that's set up at the end of the issue. Is it too late for them to have finally consolidated all of these gangs together to face each other?
Is it too late? I don't know if I would say it's too late. What I would say is, why is this so much of the focus of the Amazing Spider-Man comic, Dan? I think that is my biggest problem with it. I mean, you know, maybe it's too late in the context of like, what were the previous three ASMs and then the one alpha issue or whatever you want to call it. We didn't necessarily set up that this was going to be the showdown per se, at least certainly not like in the very literal terms that we got at the end of this issue where they're, you know, like a Marvel movie trailer running at each other, or the X-Men animated series, which was an also good pull, Dan. I feel like this comic has really strayed very far from the Spider-Man part of whatever this storyline was going to be. And I would love to say, like, oh man, what a shocking turn of events that Amazing Spider-Man loses the core thesis of its central character. But like, it's not a shock. This is how many times have we been in this place now when it comes to these major storylines within this book? And it's, you know, it is a trend going on 10 years now. What's the common thread? I don't know, Dan. I'll leave it for you, dear listeners, to decide. But the bottom line is that we are just moving far and away and from the Spider-Man of it all. And I'm not even saying that what we're getting here is bad storytelling, but I don't know how I'm supposed to be invested as a reader of The Amazing Spider-Man right now.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, I think back to like Sinister War, which is a bad story on all accounts, whether it was called Sinister War or Amazing Spider-Man. And the like dichotomy between what was called Amazing Spider-Man, what was called Sinister War, I don't think was very apparent. Like, I mean, I could tell you the difference between them, but like, I don't think that that story really needed that much space to do what it wanted to do, or at least it was misused. Whereas like, this reads like Gang War issue 4, not Amazing Spider-Man issue 42, you know, or whatever. And, you know, really like, if this was just the primary book and there was a separate Amazing Spider-Man title that told Peter's particular journey through this, like to me, that would have been a really like justified here. I think there's enough story to really get into that and like have Peter checking in on his family in the midst of all this. And I just don't know why, you know, I mean, I guess Zeb is probably busy, but like, bring in a Christos Gage or whoever to fill that out. I just think if any story like required this, it was this one, you know, and maybe some other stories too. But like, as a result, like I love all the drama that's going on the high level of this. It's really well written, except for the fact that it's called Amazing Spider-Man. And give me a sub book of just about that, and I think you would have really had a big hit here. And you know, as a result now, like, Spider-Man is the character that gets the least development of anyone in this. I mean, Luke Cage's book is doing more with Luke Cage. I don't really like that title very much so far, but like that book is doing more with that character than Spider-Man's book is doing with Spider-Man because his book is so caught up in the gang war of it all. And it's a real shame, you know, because there is a really great broad story here about this gang war that I think we're reading. But like, we can't help but knock it because I want to know why Spider-Man's in the story.
Yeah. And the thing is, the reason why I have to ding it even more so through that lens is that, you know, again, in the first strike issue, I mean, we were setting up the conflict for Peter here. You know what I mean? He was being accused of not being all there for being too up in his feelings with everything going on with MJ and Paul and all of that over the last, you know, the first year of this run, which is, you know, a complaint that, you know, frankly, the fans have had about the character for the most and the aimlessness of the series in that regard. And, you know, obviously, you know, the Randy assassination attempt was kind of like the personal stakes to kind of be like the cold water on Peter's head to get him into the game and refocused. And that's all gone out the window in favor of this other story, which is like you said, it's not a bad story. It's actually, in fact, quite a good story if you were invested in the characters of the Lincoln family drama and Count Nefaria and Madame Mask. I mean, you know, if you were someone looking for development and evolution and resolution of those characters and that family drama, I mean, you know, there's a lot going on. And certainly, you know, we are in a world right now of pop culture zeitgeist where like family drama is kind of it, you know, what are the big shows, Succession, and you know, what's going on in the real world with families and stuff like that. I mean, like it's very, very pertinent in a lot of ways, yet at the same time, like it's so far astray from, I feel like, what the thesis was that we were getting in First Strike, that I'm kind of like, I don't want to completely, you know, crap all over this story because there is some good to be found here, but like, I'm really disenfranchised from it. Like, I'm really feeling disengaged and kind of like, here we go again. Like, why are we so far from what I thought this story was going to be about through the Spider-Man lens?
Right. Yeah. And, you know, and then it, because it's not about that, it makes other things like really stand out. Like, was the Tombstone Kingpin fight fun to read on the page? Absolutely. Like, Romita Jr. knocked it out of the park with that fight, you know? And like, I actually think the response from Kingpin here is fairly in character, you know, like we just saw him resurrect his son and spend all of that time and energy with like Kindred and all that stuff we tried to forget about on resurrecting the Rose. Of course he doesn't want him to die in the first like bit major move. He knows the value of his son, and the value of his son is not running the Magia, you know? So like, that makes sense to me. I do think the whole like, why didn't you just tell us in the first place is like stupid and one of those like, you don't get a trophy for pointing out the problems with your book. But
meta
like
commentary, if that's not supposed to be meta commentary. I mean, like,
yeah. And then this is like, you know, like as on the nose that as we've ever pointed out, you know. And again, I don't really have a problem with it. It's only magnified by the fact that like we just spent a whole issue on that. And instead of getting Spider-Man stuff, and like if Kingpin had just sat it out or did that in like a couple of pages and wished his son off, fine. You know, like, I don't think any of us thought Janice was dead, you know, like that drama, like, fine. Like, I'd much rather get some Spider-Man stuff. So like where we're at right now, like we have two issues left, and I hate to judge these things based on like how much time there is left in the arc to do what I think it needs to do, which is to pivot back towards Spider-Man and make that meaningful. And certainly like, worse writers have pulled off bigger things with the Spider-Man character in two issues. Like, it's certainly possible. Does it seem likely? No. And so like, this is where we sit again in like the right before the penultimate chapter, where I feel like, just like we said during Dead Language, I think this is potentially where we just started to see the story fall apart. And again, that's not like to speak to the quality of this individual issue. It's like, there's so much left to resolve. I think it's going to be a monumental task to make Spider-Man's story mean something by the end of this tale.
It is a total here we go again kind of a moment. And like, yeah, I mean, like, and I would also say, you know, not to relitigate past reviews, but even with Dead Languages, you know, we kind of saw the wheels coming off the bus. But even then, it was still an entertaining story. It wasn't until they did what they did in the last part of it with Kamala Khan and everything that we actually were like, no, this is bad. You know, like, they shouldn't have done this, you know, like.
Yeah, I would add on top of that the Mary Jane thing even more so, because that was the long simmering, you know, thread here. Like, you know, the other big thing for me, and I think this book, as you pointed out in your recap, is like, it really tries to put in the work to make Madame Mask into like, give us more background on her and why we should care about her as the villain of this story. And it's still such an ill fit for Spider-Man comics, which is not to say like you shouldn't bring in other villains into the world of Spider-Man. We've seen it happen all the time. I mean, one of your favorites, Nothing Can Stop the Juggernaut, is all about that and incorporating Spider-Man and other people's drama. But like, when you've got a list of other gang lords, all of whom are Spider-Man villains prominently, you know, it does seem weird to foreground Madame Mask, who hasn't been seated in this run. And I think, you know, a lot of the like new things we learn about her in this issue are undercut by the fact that we don't really know how much to invest in them, because she's not a Spider-Man villain conventionally. And we'll talk about what some of those new revelations are, but I don't know whether to speculate about them and invest in them, or just to think like, okay, they're playing fast and loose with Madame Mask because she's not a Spider-Man villain.
You know, it's funny you brought up like the Juggernaut story and, you know, frankly, like any of those instances from the Roger Stern run where we used other people's villains, if you will. I mean, like, I think part of what worked in those contexts was we just kind of like plopped them in and created conflict and almost like, almost in doing less, they did more. And I actually think the the flaw here in Zeb Wells' approach with Madam Mask is he's trying to make it work. You know what I mean? It's like, look, we're painting this backstory, and like you said, it's we're doing this in the context where as readers of Spider-Man, we're like, Hammerhead's right there, Kingpin's right there, Lonnie and Janice, and like, you know, it's almost like if we just had their struggle and father-daughter dynamic, like that could have been captivating, because again, these are characters with a history with Spider-Man, and thus like their struggles are more, you know, become more central to the drama, where it's still like, okay, well, Madam Mask is having, you know, these issues with Nefaria, and this goes back to her childhood. And it's like, great, that sounds cool, but like, I've never been invested in this character in any kind of a way. So like, let her just come in and do something really nefarious to Spider-Man, like, you know, try to kill Madam Web and then just like go stomping through the middle of Manhattan and dragging Spider-Man with him, or, you know, like whatever, and be done with it. But it's like, we're trying to play like this long, clever game with her here. And I feel like the more like layers of, oh, what's this about? Oh, she's using magic. Like, she's using magic. I don't care. Why do we need another magic character in this book, Dan? Like, I know, like, it's become comical to hear me rant and rave about Secret Scrolls and stuff, but seriously, come on. Can we just have a real street-level fight here? This is a gang war, and we're playing with sigils and magic symbology again. Come on.
Yeah, no, I think you make, like, all good points. Like, yeah, start this thing off with something personal to Spider-Man that's connected to Madam Mask, you know, and it's just been a lot of subterfuge even from the beginning. Like, when we thought she was dead, it wasn't her. You know, now we're introducing even more wrinkles, but I do want to mention them just so that we're tracking the story. And again, I don't know how much to like actually invest in these. Like, so you mentioned that she's using magic, you know, Madam Mask isn't a magic using character, but here it seems to suggest that she has been through some ordeal that has allowed her to use magic. Maybe you could say she learned it when she was working with the Hood all the way back in like Bendis's run of like Avengers comics and stuff. But like, that seems like a bit of a stretch to me. And the fact that she invokes the same language used by, you know, Rabin and Wyep about the whole idea of like, I have conquered the realm of technology and magic, and she's using sigils. It's like, are we getting some tie-in to dead language, or like, is Paul involved in this in somehow? Like, what it means is anyone's guess, and it doesn't seem like it's a mistake, unless like truly Zeb just likes using this language surrounding magic. So like, I could see some desire to like tie this all together so that he can eventually do whatever he's going to do toward the end of his run to undo the Mary Jane stuff, or whatever we think his ultimate goal is. Maybe we'll look back and say, oh, this was really a clever way to like bring his whole run together. But right now it feels like, whoa, like what's coming in? You got peanut butter in my chocolate, or, you know, that sounds more pleasurable, but I didn't mind this. It made me sit up and go, wait, what is actually going on here? I mean, you seem to kind of like reject it outright, but like, do you have any thoughts about like why this is appearing here?
I will concede, if this is some way to kind of tie together the themes of the first half of this run, I mean, like, then it's worth exploring. I don't want to outright dismiss it the way I kind of sound. I mean, but like on a personal, like, this is a personal flavor. You know, you talk about peanut butter in your chocolate or whatever. Like, I would love to impose some kind of, you know, after this run or whatever, some kind of moratorium on like the mystical implementations into Spider-Man. Like, no more web of life or whatever, you know, web of truth or whatever. No more like, come on. Like, this is so far flung from who this character is and what his universe has been about for years and years. And yes, like, the only constant in comics is change. And yet, like, there are so many other characters in the Marvel universe where we can get into the mystical and the magical. I don't want Spider-Man to be that character. Like, I like, not, not every threat needs to come down to symbology and the mystical arts and some kind of incantation or MacGuffin of some sort. Like it's
or the Winkler device.
Yeah, I'm just tired of it. I really am. Like I hate to just bring in my own personal preference here, but like that's my problem with it. I mean, like I will give it a chance as a critic if this is something to do with trying to tie up all these loose ends, but like as a fan, I'm just like, ugh, like that is my initial impulse. Response to it.
Yeah, I see that 100%. And mostly for me, it's like, I feel like Wells has gone to this well too many times of like, this person is not who they appear to be, or like they're under the control of so on and so forth. And like, look, I mean, it's not that it's like entirely foreign from Spider-Man. I just like, it really like, I felt like I just got a grasp of like what Madame Mask is doing in this story. And now it's like, potential like a Mayan god might show up next issue, and it will say, you know, like, again, I'm not trying to judge this on what I think might happen, because like, who knows, but like it does open the door for like some other thing to fall into this gang war that like last minute changes what we thought we were getting in a not great way. So another change for Madame Mask: she appears to be scarred again. And again, this is hard to read on the page, like, and I think intentionally so. It's not kind of, it's one of those like Darth Vader's helmet is off in Empire Strikes Back moments where you see he's all scarred up and you're meant to like wonder who's under the mask. And here too, you know, she's got scars and we see her spraying what appears to me to be like an alternate face or like advanced makeup that hides her scars or something like that. But like readers of Madame Mask's like history know that she recently, or I guess like a couple years ago, healed the scars on her face. Maybe in learning magic and going to these other realms, she re-scarred herself, or it's not her underneath the mask. I don't know how much to read into this. Did they just not know that she's healed up again and are playing with like the fact that we've not seen Madame Mask's face before, even though we have at this point? It could just be that someone doesn't know Madame Mask's complicated history, or it's meant to be like a point. And again, that goes to using Madame Mask here, is she's not a Spider-Man villain. So how much are we meant to know about the character? Did you read anything into that? Like that we were supposed to kind of be guessing that it's not what it appears to be?
Full transparency here, Dan. No, I did not read into it. I was just like, I mean, you know, sausage making discussion here. In my original recap, I was like, she's spraying something into her face, and you kind of clarified it in my recap, because like from my mind, I just like, I'm like, all right, she's just spraying a bottle in her face. Cool. I didn't know the backstory that she healed her scars, and I don't. I mean, because I don't read a lot of books with Madame Mask in it. I just, you know, like, oops.
I mean, we had talked previously about like this face that she used to trick Hammerhead, and was that her actual face and things like that? And like, to me, this is the answer to that. It's like, no, it's not her actual face. She sprayed a mask on her face to put under her mask. Now, why she would wear it under her mask is anybody's guess, you know, like. But like, so the question is this just meant to be an answer to that, or is it meant to be something else because it got her history incorrect? Or maybe I'm incorrect and she is scarred again. I don't know. And then the last thing is she's using mind control, which like doesn't seem like it's thrown in here just to be to explain why Shotgun is siding with her. I think it opens the door for any number of people to be under her mind control. There is a moment at the end of her conversation with Janice, which we're going to talk about after the break, where she touches Janice's arm at the end of the conversation. And it's probably just light acting from John Romita Jr., but like, I could very well see them being like, that's where she implemented her like sigil and mind control on Janice. It's probably not going to be that, but like, they've opened this door now, this can of worms that anyone could be under her control. And you know, again, to your point about can't we just have a simple gang war? Well, now, like, that seems to be potentially endlessly complicated, which is not a knock on the book, but it could be.
I mean, you say endlessly complicated. I'm going to go one step harsher and say it's a little lazy, Dan. I mean, like, it's like if you know, it's kind of like stuff with the Jackal or even, you know, the Hobgoblin in recent years, where it's like, you know, if there's always going to be this like out of, well, so-and-so was under my control, or like, you know, so-and-so was just a clone of a clone of a clone of a clone, or, you know, I just tricked him into thinking he was the Hobgoblin. Like, there's always going to be a trap door at the end of the story that to me feels like a cheat. And you know, we have to see it play out. I'm not saying can't call something lazy that hasn't played out, but like if it's just going to be like, now we're going to introduce the fact that she could just mind control anybody with a touch of a hand, like I think that's a poor choice, I will just say, in terms of storytelling. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, let's see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, if people want to keep up with all of our coverage of the entire gang war and all the other things that we're doing, Mark, why don't you tell everybody where they can do that?
Well, of course, they should become a subscriber of the Amazing Spider Talk on Substack. That's right, baby. We are going back to the future by coming up with some written long form content. You can, of course, subscribe by going to amazingspider.substack.com. Dan, it's a regular newsletter, comes out about every 2 weeks. It is completely free to sign up. We just want your email and your support. Just a couple of things that have come up in recent editions of the Substack, Dan. We talked about the really huge Ultimate Spider-Man number one that's now apparently like selling for like $50-$60 on eBay. Have you seen this?
Yeah, I've seen it for even more. Yeah.
Yeah, and the regular cover sells more than the variant cover. So go figure that one, folks. In an upcoming Substack that's going to be coming out, we're going to give our remembrances of the Barack Obama issue, Amazing Spider-Man 583, which celebrated its 15th anniversary this week. We're also going to talk a little bit about Jackpot number one. I mean, there's just so much going on in the Substack, Dan. Anything you want to throw out there?
Well, it was funny because in our Slack, which we should mention as well, come join our Slack, one of our listeners was commenting, man, you know, I'm always amazed that you and Mark are such good writers. And I said, really, you should be amazed that we're such good podcasters, because like we are primarily writers. Like that's our trade. Like we both started in writing, and we actually bonded over like mutual writing. Like really, the Substack is like us in our truest form, which is like writing great prose and reviews and things like that. So if you enjoy this show and you're like, I want more, but maybe even potentially better, it might be in the Substack. So again, check out amazingspider.substack.com so you too can be surprised at how good of podcasters Mark and I are compared to our even better writing.
I mean, I'm sure some people would disagree with both of those accolades, Ted, but yeah, do it. Definitely sign, subscribe today and join our written conversation. All right, Dan, back to the review. Why don't we talk a little bit about what's going on with Janice Lincoln here? What stood out to you the most? The fact that I keep calling her Janice, even though I think you want to call her Janice or whatever it is, or what else you got?
I can't actively correct myself before saying it. So like, if I'm wrong, I'm sorry. Like this is my like Sajani moment, and you can send Jimmy the elbow after me if you really want to. So Janice or Janice Lincoln. I see, now I don't even know which one you're saying. I'm just going to say them both. She's the other half of this this war. You know, I think it's clear at this point that this is kind of her story, the gang war. Like she's really the character that we're meant to be tracking, I think, through all of this. Now that might change in the final two issues, but I think by now, like her kind of arc into Avenger, so to speak, of her father's turf and someone who sees the infantilization of her father and his distance from her throughout her life is manifest in daddy issues have manifest into taking over Manhattan and the various boroughs. Where we arrive at in this issue, with this conversation between her and Mask. I think it's very natural. Like, I enjoyed this discussion in the issue, and like, would I have liked to see a lot of this stuff play out on the page? Yeah, I think we've seen Janice's stuff play out on the page. Mask being an outsider here, this feels like holy invention on the page here. But I thought that this scene between them was the heart of the issue and the strongest part of the issue, that I think was mostly a phone-in from John Romita Jr., except for this part of the issue where they slowly like turn to confront each other, and you got that amazing reflection of Mask in Janice's eye. Like, to me, this scene really worked in an issue that otherwise kind of felt meandering or like a check-in.
I feel like Janice is definitely the hero of this story, if you will, or maybe the anti-hero, but she is, you know, she is the one making things move right now. I I'm not going to sit here and rate a story over what I wish it was versus what I, you know, what it actually is. But with that said, like, I would like to see a little more complexity to her journey here, if that makes sense. You know, like, it's, and maybe this is just my reading of it, Dan, and you might disagree, but like, I feel like we are being set up to root for her in this with Mask. And, you know, at the end of the day, like, I don't know if either should be the hero here. You know what I mean? Like, it's, you know, like, Janice might be like maybe it's just my affinity for underdogs that's making me root for her. I don't know. But like, there's just a part of me that's like, you know, this war is, you know, again, going back to First Strike with the setup, you know, it is terrorizing New York, and it's knocking these heroes on their heels, you know, spreading out, splitting up to try and defend New York and clean it up. And, you know, I feel like for the most part in the pages of this book, Janice has been kind of like, you know, disavowed of her responsibility to that. And, you know, again, two issues left, a lot of that can change in a heartbeat. But like, it's just, I agree in the central thesis here that like, she's kind of the heart of the story right now, but like, I want to see some more layers to that. I mean, like, it was good to kind of, like you said, get more of that it's, you know, subtext became text here with her in Tombstone. But now I need more with her character and her journey specifically, I think, to kind of bring this home, to make it matter, you know, like, because it's still kind of like, oh, OK, you know, this new player in the field is making a move and you kind of want to root for her. But so what at the end of the day?
I agree with you mostly, but I do think that we as the reader are kind of expected to know that this is not going to go the way that we might hope. But we're still, like, we like this person, so we don't want to see harm come her way. And so the real kind of like conflict here is with the reader going like, this looks like it's inevitable to become a train crash. How do we get out of it? And Tombstone, I think, embodies that here, where he says, like, you know, as much as I don't want to see her lose, I'm even more afraid of what it would mean if she would win, you know, because he doesn't want her to basically take up his lifestyle. You know, which I think largely why you and I think there's a big target on Tombstone as the character to die, to save his daughter from like living the lifestyle that he has lived. You know, if I had to put money down, that's where I put my chips. Right. Whatever hope I have for this story to pull it off in the final two issues really comes out of Spider-Man's mouth in the like final part of this book, which is that like he finally says like, hey, this is my city and they hurt my friend and we're going to get our own gang basically together, our team together, and we're going to put a stop to this, you know, which is to say like neither party is right and Spider-Man is going to solve it in whatever way. But my big fear, and this is, I'm going to put it out here now because I'll be really disappointed if this is where this goes. My big fear is that Spider-Man gets his own gang together and it becomes a standard might makes right superhero trope where basically like Spider-Man's gang of brutes end up, you know, and heroes end up being stronger than everybody else. And the heroes prove their worth by outpowering everybody else. And I, like, to me, that theme or that idea is so bankrupt of like the morals that I think Spider-Man can best embody, which is like using his head, using his empathy, et cetera, to get us out of it, and is beautifully embodied by the World Without Love story that started this run, where like Spider-Man gets duped and instead of going and beating up Tombstone, he goes into his house and like he basically empathizes with him and makes a deal that they can kind of come out of there with a better understanding. And I just have so much fear that this just becomes a big brawl where Spider-Man like and Tombstone prove themselves stronger than everybody else. I just wanted to lay it out there because that's my huge fear for where this story is headed.
Yeah, well, like we've been saying with every other major point we've been raising here, gotta wait and see, Dan. You know what I mean? Like we can't.
I can feel it happening. Like we've been in this. Like Mark, you and I have been at this for 10 years. I could feel this about to happen, and I'm like, please. Like I'm putting it out there. I'm like, please, Zeb Wells, be smarter than this. Like it's an event story. It doesn't mean it has to be like event dumb. Like. Have Spider-Man swing between those two converging X-Men tribes and make a big speech and everybody goes home. Like do almost anything to subvert my expectations. Like, please let me be a nihilist in vain, you know? Like, yeah.
All right. Anything else you want to bring up while we're here and talking about it, Dan, or do we want to get to
Mark, are you as fearful of that as me? Like, do you feel like it's headed that direction?
I don't know if I'm as convinced as you are that that's where it's headed. If anything, I'm more concerned by, I mean, I guess that would, this, that ending would qualify as something in the realm of aimlessness. I am more concerned by how kind of, I think, meandering this story has become right now. You know, we are, I feel, kind of circling the wagons in a lot of ways. I mean, yes, okay, we could say that stuff with the Kingpin was in character, but like, I mean, we really are, I know we said this a few minutes ago, but we really are staring in the face that like literally an entire issue of this arc was rendered pointless by this comic. Say what you will about it, our enjoyment factor of it, et cetera. But like, what was the point of that? And you know, like, why can't we just tell a tighter story here? In regardless of what the outcome is going to be, if it's what you say it's going to be, I would just say like another common kind of, I would say, unsatisfactory thing that we've been getting with a lot of these Spider-Man event stories is, you know, to your description, like kind of just like, here's all the cavalry and, you know, everything gets tidied up in an issue, whether it would be Spider-Verse or Sinister War or, you know, like whatever even Dead Languages, you know, it was like, here's the Fantastic Four and Captain America and everyone's here to help Spider-Man save the day and then stand over Kamala Khan's body. Let's, go against type here, you know, like that's all I will say. We're regardless of what your prediction is, like, I want to be surprised here. I've not been surprised, I think, in a very pleasant way by this book since, frankly, all the way back to that first arc that you know, World Without Love, that we were talking about. And I know it's there. I know it's within these creators to do it. So let's surprise me. You know, I think.
Yeah.
That's where
I'm at. Cause like the end of this book is very simple. It's like two parties running at each other. And like the promise is, I think, mutual assured destruction. Right. And like, how do you prevent mutually assured destruction? I just hope it's smarter than, well, you get a bigger gun than they have, you know? Yeah. All right. So grades, I'm giving this one a C+.
I am at a C- for me.
Okay. Great, let's move on. Mark, why don't you take us home?
Of course. It is that time, Dan. Time for all good things to come to an end. So we want to say thank you to you, the listeners and viewers, for tuning in to this episode of The Amazing Spider Talk.
Yeah, this podcast exists because of listener support on Patreon. For only $3.99 a month, you can help to support our show's existence while getting early episodes, including these reviews the same week the comics release, exclusive artwork, and a ton of other bonuses. A thank you to everyone who already supports us and the work that we do. Plus, we wanted to extend a special thanks to our newest contributors, Connor Kamadi, Matt Welty, Evan Gabovich, Deacon Tuttle, and Timothy May.
Thanks to all of you. Dan and I really want to increase all of the awesome work that we do in 2024. So if you are already a patron or want to become one, please help us to meet our goals and make this a better podcast by considering supporting our show. Just go to AmazingSpiderTalk.com and click on the big Patreon button to get started.
This podcast episode was edited by Rick Coase. The video version of the show is available on YouTube and was edited by Alex Galecki. Our artwork comes handcrafted by artists Ron Friend, Sal Buscema, and Nick Cagnetti. Our theme songs were produced by Rylan Bojack, Tony Thaxton, and Spider Madge. And our animated intro was created and performed by Josh Sutton. Don't forget to subscribe to our Amazing Spider Talk Substack. That's amazingspider.substack.com. We're covering all of Gang War, Ultimate Spider-Man, the entire Spider Office's line of comics there. Amazingspider.substack.com. Truly, it's the second half of the podcast. So, Mark, until we start a Gang War amongst Spider-Man podcasts just to blow off some steam, what's our motto?
With great podcasts, there must also come the Amazing Spider Talk.
Don't miss the next